My name is Edgar Mannheimer, and this is Kalam, a podcast about the Middle East.
Your Jaffa resembles mine, but it's not the same. Two cities impersonating each other. You carved your names in my city, so I feel like I am a returnee from history, always tired, roaming my own life like a ghost. Yes, I am a ghost who lives in your city. You too are a ghost living in my city, and we call both cities Jaffa.
That was an excerpt from the 2014 Book of Disappearance by the Palestinian author Ibtissam Azim, today's guest on the Kalam podcast. And we'll be getting back to Ibtissam and her brilliant Palestinian science fiction in just a minute. But first, we'd like to remind you that if you like the show, please give it a rating in whatever podcast application you're listening to right now. And please subscribe. This seemingly vain request, in fact, helps other people find the podcast. And if you want to support us materially, you can do so by joining our Patreon community at patreon.com/kalampodcast. There, you'll find full-length interviews with all our guests, as well as bonus content. Soon, we'll be launching Kalam Shorts, where the researcher for this podcast, Sam Karlshamre, will give 10 to 15 minute explainers of terminology important to our subject, like settler colonialism, Orientalism, and Zionism. You'll have access to all that and more for just $3 a month. Now, on to the show. What if all Palestinians would disappear? Not in a figurative sense, or even through ethnic cleansing or genocide. What if they simply vanished out of thin air? What would that do to Israeli society? This is the premise of the Palestinian author Ibtissam Azim's Book of Disappearance, first published in Arabic in 2014. Book of Disappearance is a kind of Palestinian science fiction. In it, Israelis wake up one day to the news that every single Palestinian, both inside and outside Israel, has vanished out of thin air. Panic ensues. Israelis think that an attack is imminent. But nothing happens. The Palestinians have simply gone. "Have all our problems disappeared?" asks one news headline. The book follows two main characters, Israeli Ariel and Palestinian Ala, who live in the same building in Jaffa, once the largest city in Palestine and now a suburb of Tel Aviv. Ariel is a liberal Zionist and a journalist whose father tells him heroic tales from his time as a soldier. Ariel is friends with Ala, whose grandmother tells him tales of the Jaffa that disappeared in 1948. Ala disappeared with the rest of the Palestinians, but leaves behind a diary, which Ariel finds and reads. In it, he gains insights into what Palestinian citizens of Israel like Ala truly think of Israeli society. Book of Disappearance is a truly fascinating read, and Ibtissam Azim, who grew up as a Palestinian citizen of Israel, masterfully portrays the hard truths and complexities of Israeli society. If you haven't listened to the previous episodes of the Kalam podcast, I would strongly encourage you to, especially episode 1 on the Nakba with the author Suad Al-Amri. Her 2022 novel Mother of Strangers details another disappearance from Jaffa, the very real ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948. In a way, this episode can almost be seen as a sequel to that. Book of Disappearance is an eerie read, as if predicting October 7, 2023. The protagonist Ariel, who I mentioned earlier, writes in the days following the disappearance about a Facebook post by a Palestinian blogger, Badriya, who writes, "We will not be silent anymore," just hours before the Palestinians disappear. Ariel tries to interpret this in light of the sudden disappearance. Quote, "Does that mean that the Palestinians will use force to realize their demands? Have they all united and planned something and outsmarted the security forces? Were they able to penetrate the security barrier so easily?" end quote. The book was translated into English by the renowned Iraqi-American poet, translator, and scholar Sinan Antoun. Coincidentally, Sinan was detained on Monday night for protesting at the NYU University campus in New York City, where he's an associate professor. The protest movement on U.S. campuses, spearheaded by Columbia University, also in New York City, is inspiring, and we will be covering this movement shortly on Kalam. Now, without further ado, here's Ibtisam Azim. So thank you so much for this reading, and thank you very much for taking the time to be a guest on the Kalam podcast.
No, thank you for having me. Ahla wa sahla.
So, Ibtisam Azim, what happens when all the Palestinians disappear?
Well, I guess you have to read the novel. But seriously, this novel was published in 2014 in Arabic. And the idea of the disappearance have many different layers. Some I wanted on a part to mirror what happened in 1948-47, the Nakba, and to show that such a scenario that happened more than 75 years ago could happen again, and unfortunately, and of course in a different way, no historic event repeat itself, but there is always similarities. And we Palestinians talk about the continuous Nakba, because it is true that there was the event of the Nakba, which in which more than 750,000 Palestinians were displaced and never allowed back. They were displaced by a Zionist militant group back then. And the displacement continued in a different ways, whether for those who stayed in their homeland, historic Palestine, or those who became refugees. And some Palestinians today, whether they are refugees in Syria or in Lebanon or within historic Palestine, whether in the West Bank or Gaza, fled their houses again and again and again, and we see that in Gaza. So the disappearance is symbolic for a lot of issues that happened in the Palestinian history, but it's also was for me back then when I wrote it a kind of warning for a scenario that could happen again in a different way.
But I mean, the book is so fascinating because it shows this kind of, through this like surrealism, because it is a kind of sci-fi thing that even though it kind of did happen in 1948, yes, this is a kind of, they completely disappear out of thin air.
Yes.
And it kind of shows how, because you trace a lot of Israelis in the book, and it shows how their relationship to, guest workers, Palestinians who come over the border every day to work in farms or to other cleaners, the working class basically that keeps Israel going. Mm. And Israelis' relationship to these people, which is just this kind of like specter, you know, they don't speak their language, they don't know anything about them, but they come and they run the country essentially, and then they all disappear. Where did you get this kind of brilliant idea from?
Well, we have to go back to several things. First, we have the major character, who's Ala, the Palestinian, who writes memoirs to his grandmother after she dies. And the chapter I read was part of his memoirs to her, or what he's writing to her. So there is the Israeli, one of the major characters is also an Israeli journalist who tries to understand what's happening with the disappearance. But I wanted to talk also about, I noticed, I was born and grew up in a small town in the north of Jaffa. My grandmother, maternal grandmother, is actually originally from Jaffa, but she was displaced in 48. So my mother was a few months or maybe 1 year old when she was internally displaced. I grew up in Taibe. I went to study at the Hebrew University before leaving, and then studying also at in Germany and ending up in New York. What I noticed when I grew up back home, that a lot of so-called liberal Israelis If they will talk about the so-called two-state solution, there will be a talk about the occupation of the rest of Palestine in 1967, but the cause issue, the main issue, and that's the Nakba and the Zionist movement and what has been, and the British occupation and what has been happening in for Palestinians and in Palestine, it's always something that they don't want to talk about. It's a taboo. And there's very good reasons why not. There's excuses why they don't want to talk about it. So for me, it was important to talk about the cause and the real issue and to talk about the root, why we are here today, what brought us here. And there is another thing that is we cannot look at Palestine without, or we cannot talk about Palestine without talking about it as in the context of settler colonialism, because this is what's happening in Palestine. So that novel brings things to their root. And the fact that many Palestinians for Israelis are actually invisible, and they are visible. So the disappearance has also this meaning of what does it mean to be invisible somehow. And when they are visible, they are visible as, quote-unquote, a problem. And even when we today, even in the mainstream Western media, it's always, there are a lot of protests that was happening in Gaza, peaceful protest on the border for years. It was hardly covered. Only when there is a violent action, then it brings attention. But talking about the disappearance, there is another issue, and that is the issue of the city of Jaffa. Jaffa was the most important city in Palestine before 48. It was the largest, it was economically very developed, it has all the publishing houses, cinemas, etc. And what happened in 48, 47, and why we constantly as Palestinians go back to that issue is because you cannot understand why we got today to where we got without understanding that not only that 750,000 were displaced and never allowed back, etc., despite UN resolutions, 194, the right of return, the right of self-determination, there were also about 500 villages that were completely destroyed, more than 11 towns that were emptied, today Lid, Ramle, Haifa, Jaffa, etc. And my grandparents are part of these very small groups who stayed in historic Palestine, or what became later Israel. And we grew up in a way, not only, I wouldn't even say second-class citizen, I would say, we were forced often not to talk about ourselves, denied our right to talk about self, to talk about the place as Palestine, and whether through the education system in which I went to schools, it's an Arabic school, but the education system is an Israeli education system, which meant also that the way we learned history was from the perspective of our colonizers. And I learned Hebrew, most of the Hebrew literature we learned at school was Zionist literature, talking about Palestine as an empty land. When I went back home and I was talking to my grandparents, they will talk about a totally different world, totally different story. So this is also where the idea came from. Because my grandmother, who was internally displaced, never allowed back because of different, although she stayed in the country, but the Israelis put several laws, including present absence laws, where even if you are present in the country, you're not allowed to go back to your house. And your house was confiscated. This is how they took also over most of the land. So for this grandmother, when we will go to Jaffa, we will be literally walking through streets that had different names that they gave. And she will talk about different names. And when you, as a Palestinian, walk through your homeland in different places, even in Jerusalem, you have all these street names that named after people who were responsible for massacres and for your killing. And they are seen as heroes. So you grew up in this atmosphere, and you have to find your way how to decolonize your education system, your mind, to learn how to know better about your own history, the history of your people. So this is like all comes together. And the novel tries to go beyond these political layers, but rather to make it more understandable. Also, what does it mean for Israelis where the creation of their country was built on a myth and on the existence of so-called Palestinian enemies? What happened if this enemy disappeared? How would the Israeli society deal with that issue? So the novel goes also into that. But I tried my best to give these different characters and different perspectives within the Israeli society. But I didn't want only to talk about the Israeli society, because this is not my main issue. My main issue is to tell the story of my people in a different way, in a literary way, that also tries to understand what happens beyond the headlines that you see in the news, the personal stories, the joy, but also the pain, how this conflict affects people and what does it mean for their destiny and for their daily life, and how they go on about their lives despite these catastrophes that's happening to them.
Yeah. Yeah, when you were talking about how many in Israeli society see Palestine and Palestinians as simply a problem, and you have this very sort of, it's funny, well, it's dark humor
yes.
in your book, an example of a fictitious article title where it says, "Are all our problems over now?"
Yes.
Or "Have our problems disappeared?" But when you speak about Jaffa and about historic Palestine and what it was, which was, it's almost like a civilization that disappeared, mm-hmm. almost. It reminds me a lot of Saad Al-Amri, mm-hmm. who was the guest on the first episode of the series in the Kalam podcast. And her book, Mother of Strangers, from 2022, also traces several people living in Jaffa at the time. Mm-hmm. And also because you mentioned the festival of the Prophet Reuben.
Yes.
And this kind of thing where, at least according to Saad Al-Amri, Arabs and Jews and mm-hmm. Jewish Arabs and Christians and Muslims all kind of celebrated it together on the beach, and it was just, it's so hard to picture it,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost like thinking of the lost civilizations in North and South America,
mm-hmm.
but the difference is that this is not even 100 years ago. Ala, one of the characters in the book, he has all these memories from his grandmother who witnessed that and then witnessed what happened after, and she was one of the ones that stayed behind. Is this kind of autobiographical in a way? Do you have the same experience in your family?
I mean, as I mentioned a little bit before, that it is inspired, that his relationship to his grandmother inspired by my own relationship to my grandmother, but it's not autobiographical. I did also some interviews with people from Jaffa, so it's so in literature sometimes you need to bring a character into life. So it's inspired by my grandmother, but it's not her personal story, and it's mixed with other stories in order to crystallize other issues that has to do with people who live or are stayed behind. You know, when you write fiction, when I wrote the Book of Disappearance, when I came up with the idea and started planning what do I want to do with it and with the characters, once you start writing, whatever you planned also disappears sometimes, because you have, as an author, to have a very, I don't know how to call it, maybe organic relationship with the characters in a way. Yes, of course, you write their destiny, but you need to put you need to let them also take their own way and not to impose your own political views on them and your own beliefs. So you need to go with them if you want and to live under their skin for the time of the writing. So it develops also once you are writing. But it's inspired from real events, but it took its own way and own structure once you start. And it's important even, and I say it a lot of times, that even characters that you don't agree with politically and you have in your stories, it's important to give them the depth needed and the three-dimensional way to... So it's actually, it makes it believable, and it's more, it's better for the work, definitely, because otherwise it will be cliches, and this is not what, and I mean, this is not what I want my work to be. Yeah. So, yeah.
And it's definitely not. Yeah. It's very credible and sort of believable, the way that you paint these characters. You described growing up, learning about Palestinian history from Israeli teachers and from a Zionist perspective in Hebrew. And you kind of mentioned going, kind of having to decolonize your way of thinking and going through a transformation. And obviously, it's very different from someone Israeli going through the same thing. But I'm reminded of how Gideon Levy talks about how he went through this kind of transformation. Can you talk a little bit about how that was, and also how it was growing up in the shadow of your culture that kind of disappeared, and how it was being a young woman in north of Jaffa?
Well, as I said, you know, in Israel, there's schools where the major language for Palestinians, you are taught in Arabic, but the colloquium is in Israeli. But the Hebrew lessons that we learn Hebrew as a first foreign language. Mm. And the Hebrew literature we learned back then at school, when I was at school, was most of it very Zionist literature. Now, what we learned in history was taught to us by a Palestinian teacher, but the colloquium was Israeli. So we will learn officially what we are supposed to learn, but the teacher will say, okay, this is what officially the state wants us to believe, but our story is X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. And then at home also, you will talk to parents, etc. But we have to remember, until the 80s, and these teachers will risk their jobs, because until the 80s and even 90s, a lot teachers could be fired. Palestinian teachers, citizens of Israel, could be fired if they will talk about politics and comes out. And I know, actually, for the novel I'm working at now, I know somebody who was fired in the 70s. So that's one thing. So when I went to schools back then in the 80s and 90s, there was no widespread internet. So today, a lot of kids can do through internet get also a lot of information. We got, but as I said, teachers would tell us their perspective. There is other alternative way to learn. Some political movements that they will come to schools and talk to us about these issues. But I grew up with a lot of fear and racism, and a lot of not only settler colonialist systems, but also a lot of macroaggressions. So when I went to Jerusalem to study at the Hebrew University, there was a very strong Palestinian students movement there. So that was very helpful. But a lot of people were also end up in jails, and a lot of people in demonstration will be beaten up. And then there was the first intifada and the second intifada, etc. You know, when there were some right-wing demonstrations by Israelis, chantings like death to Arabs was something very normal that I grew up with. It is, when I think about it, it's scary to say that, but it's the truth. It's the way that many of us grew up with.
Since then, you've lived in Germany, in Freiburg and Berlin, and now you live in New York. Do you consider yourself now kind of a writer in the diaspora, or do you still consider yourself Palestinian in the sense that Palestine is your home and you're just kind of living in other places?
I mean, when I left Jerusalem to continue studying in Freiburg in Germany and finished my master's and then started journalism, etc., my intention wasn't to stay there. I must say, I was in Jerusalem, I was suffocating. Also, as a woman, I mean, we have to talk. I try to talk about it also in my writing. Sometimes when you As a Palestinian, you're occupied with talking about the political issues, but there is a lot to talk about also within our society, patriarchy, etc. So that was one reason why I felt like I'm suffocating. And then another reason, and the main reason, was the political thing, the colonialization and occupation, etc. So I thought I'm leaving, continue studying, and I will come back. And I'm still thinking I'm going to go back. And I go back every year. Sometimes I stay for 3 months for work or writing, research. Diaspora is a complicated word because I know that it's used a lot to talk about Palestinians, but I would say for the majority of Palestinians who live abroad, I would say they live in exile because they are forced to live there and not allowed back. And we have today more than 5 million Palestinians who are still refugees, because they are not allowed back. This is the children of refugees from 48 and their grandchildren, etc. And they are in refugee camps, in some of them, not all of them, in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. But whether they have the refugee status or not, or etc., at the end of the day, the majority of Palestinians are not allowed to go back home. So I am maybe one of the lucky ones who can go still visit my family, and I hope I will be back. When I lived in Germany, or now when I live in New York, I usually tend to try to learn as much as possible about the cultures and the place where I live, the languages, etc., etc. But I'm always also very strongly connected to my own culture. So despite the fact that more than 20 years I'm living abroad, but I write in Arabic, and I chose to write in Arabic, and there's a lot of reasons why I do it, but the connection to the language, the beauty of the language, and it's my culture, and etc., but also some political reasons. So I am probably one of these immigrants who very well integrated to the societies they live in, but still very well connected to their homeland. And I don't feel also the urge to be hyphenate like Arab American or Palestinian American or whatever. It's I'm Palestinian, full stop.
Yeah. I think the notion of Palestinians disappearing, or the Palestinian issue disappearing, or the al-Qadiyya, al-Falastiniya disappearing, has been a real fear for many people for the past few years. And you wrote your book in 2014, and between 2014 and basically October 7, this was the fear, I think, of many Palestinians and many activists in who talk about Palestine, because of the Abraham Accords, because of the complete absence of any kind of interest from the West, and peace deal, you don't even talk about it, and obviously the far-right pivot in Israel, and the continued violence, and the continued building of settlements, and all of this kind of, and then you have this eruption on October the 7th, and since then, the complete slaughter, obviously, of Israelis, but now of more than 30,000 Palestinians, almost half of them children. And at the same time, it's top of mind for most people around the world, I would say. Everyone is talking about Palestine now. How do you relate to that? How do you see yourself as a creator in the middle of this thing that's going on?
For me, it's important, even before this last war on Gaza, it's important for me, not only as a Palestinian, but my view in general, that as a creator of fiction, it's important to be aware of the socio-economic, political, gender, etc., situation in which your characters are living in. You have to be careful also not to make your character being, when they talk, as if it's a manifesto. But it's important that you put them in this situation, and you, how you do it is up to you. But as a writer, you have to be aware of that. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. And you don't have to be aware of that only if you're a Palestinian, or of anyone who comes from let's say, a country in which there's war. I think if you're in Sweden or in any place that it doesn't have a war, it's important to take this and be aware of it. On top of that, for me, as a Palestinian, and when I see what's happening now in Gaza, I'm also a journalist, I work as a correspondent for one of the Arabic newspapers. I'm their correspondent at the UN in New York. And, you know, when you work as a correspondent, and especially when you cover the UN, you cover UN Security Council, so you cover the Palestine, but you also cover other issues, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, you name it, Afghanistan, etc. So it gives you also a perspective on other people's problems and wars, and it gives you a place to reflect on your own issue in a different, sometimes in a different way, and to put everything in perspective. For me, with what's happening now in Gaza, and seeing my voice as a journalist, I feel it's extremely important also when I am in these press conferences and to ask the critical questions, especially when you deal with diplomats, Western diplomats, to ask the critical questions that many, unfortunately, of our Western colleagues are not asking, although they have the ability to do that. They have the privilege, more privilege than I would say I have, for a very simple reason. When you work for a mainstream media, Western media, you have more privileges. That's a fact. Yeah. But also because I saw how they were talking and asking critical questions when Russian, for example, diplomats will come in front of them when it was about Ukraine and the Russian invasion to Ukraine. So some of these same journalists who were extremely critical and were doing their job to report about Ukraine the way one should report, one of a sudden they are dead silent when it came to Palestine. One of a sudden we see reporting that constantly brings almost everything that being reported on the ground from Palestinian journalists, from Palestinian activists, whenever they will ask a question about, or even the UN, they will bring always a statement for IDF spokesperson. And it's like, did you do that when Russia invaded Ukraine? I mean, of course, you need to listen to all sides, but why is it? It's a different standard. But then for me also as a writer, I'm not a big fan. I mean, I'm on social media, on Twitter and on Instagram, Facebook less. But it's important that I also, on my platform, I use that platform to talk about what's happening and to give a voice to especially to people who are on the ground, other Palestinians who are reporting from Gaza, and to retweet or tweet their articles, what they are saying, what they are showing, because I know that I have different people who are following me that not necessarily are going to follow. So it's important to give space to other Palestinian voices and voices who are talking on this issue, and also use any opportunity to talk about what's happening in Gaza and to bring attention to it. This is the minimum. This is really the absolute minimum that I can do as a Palestinian in this case. And of course, you also write about it as a journalist, but that's then in addition.
Yeah, I hope hearing your words that our Western colleagues will do their job when it comes to covering Palestine.
I hope so.
Thank you so much,
Ibtissam
Awsam. It was a true pleasure speaking with you today.
No, thank you for this interview. And thank you. How do you say thank you in Swedish?
Tack.
Tack. Oh. Yeah. That's easy. Tack, tack.
That was the Palestinian author Ibtissam Awsam and the 7th episode of the Kelam podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Next week, I'll be speaking to Munir Atallah, a Palestinian-American filmmaker and the head of production and acquisition at the newly created distribution and production company, Watermelon Pictures. Watermelon aims to promote and curate cinema about Palestine and Palestinians, This is, of course, in the context of the American film industry and its notorious Orientalist depictions of Arabs as terrorists and savages. That's next time on the Kalam podcast. Kalam was written and hosted by me, Edgar Mannheimer. Research and production by Sam Karl Samra. Poetry reading in Arabic by Khulud Saghir. And sound design by Arthur Mannheimer.